On Sunday, June 15th at 11 p.m., Shug in My Bowl will feature one of New York's in-demand session drummers and one-third of what has been called an avant metal jazz band, Harriet Tubman, drummer J.T. Lewis. Join us as this exploration is mostly conducted by Shug associate producer Hank Williams. That's Sunday, June 15th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned.
So funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on.
All right, you're listening to WBAI New York, as I mentioned. This is Joyce Jones and Sugar in My Bowl. Our guest for this evening is J.T. Lewis, so stay tuned. I'm so sorry I'm late. That was not the plan. Anyway, you know, you try to do the stuff in the summer when the varying events are going on, and you just can't do them all. And this is my first time late, so hopefully it'll be my last. This is WBAI, as I keep saying, because you need to know. And this is Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Stay tuned.
You've been acting different, I've been told. Soothe me, I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Brooklyn Museum. I guess it was a First Saturdays or something like that back in the early 2000s.
For that artist.
Yes.
That painter. I forgot his name. His brother.
Kehinde Wiley. Kehinde. Maybe.
Wow. You were there for that.
I was there for that.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that very much. We love playing in our hometown. You know, and it's really funny where promoters, we find out, you know, they're discouraged. Well, they always tell us that, well, your music is too, people are not going to like, your people, they try to, quote unquote, they don't say it, but they imply it. Well, your people don't listen to this. What do you, wait, this is our people's music. Just let them hear it. And we realize that they know exactly what we're doing. And all of the references from our history are in there. And they hear it more than anybody else, you know, our people.
Right.
You know, they hear our stuff. Everybody carries around our stuff, you know. And maybe they haven't heard it the way we present it. But when they hear it, you know, people come to us and go, man, that was like a revival. It was like a revival. It's like I was at my grandmother's revival meeting. It was like a tent, but a revival. That's one of the greatest compliments you can get, you know, from sisters and brothers. They're like, that felt like a revival, you know. So, and that's what keeps us going, because when in the mainstream of the business world, if you believe what they tell you, you wouldn't get out of bed.
And so, well, we've been listening to J.T. Lewis here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm here with our associate producer.
This is Hank Williams.
We're visiting drummer J.T. Lewis, who is a, how do you describe, I was going to say a member of Harriet Tubman. Is that accurate?
Yeah, co-conspirator. It's a cooperative with my brothers, Brandon Ross on guitars and banjos and all strings, and Melvin Gibbs on basses. And we've been conspirators for almost 16 years now. Band is 16 years old. It's a teenager. It's an unruly teenage kid.
Thank you, J.T. Lewis, for allowing us to visit your space here.
It's an honor to have you guys here in Home Cooking Studios, Bed-Stuy, New York City. Thank you for coming.
So let's start at the beginning. I understand you are a New Yorker from Jamaica, Queens.
Yep, native. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what was happening in Jamaica, Queens?
Well, I'm still trying to figure out what's happening in Jamaica, Queens, because it's something in the water. But we were just raised to be musicians, even when I was 6 years old. My first drum teacher, Artie Simmons, who was Roy Haynes' cousin, had a band called the Jazz Samaritans. And, I mean, Lenny White was playing in that band, Clint Houston. I wasn't like a gym rat, but I was a studio rat. And I used to just hang out. Because they were always, Billy Cobham was over there, you know, Ted Dunbar. So, I mean, think about it, 7, 8 years old, and you're just hanging around, and this is what you're supposed to do. And not only that, but Roy Haynes kept a drum set at his cousin's house. So my first drum lesson was on a Roy Haynes drum set. I mean, that's the beauty of Queens. There was so much music there.
About how old were you then?
I was around 9, 10. And my parents would let me go across the street to listen to the music. They were rehearsing. And the brother, Artie Simmons, at the time, drums was his second instrument. He was a trombonist, still is, and a music arranger. He was playing with Duke Ellington. He was in the Duke Ellington big band when I was living across the street as a kid. So the environment, which my mom used to call fertile soil, was just ripe for learning. And they would always take the time to show the charts and how to read them. So by the time I got into junior high school, when the teachers would put the, I was eating that up, because I got the training from the real guys when I was a kid. And the culture of Jamaica, Queens was just so rare. There were bands in every neighborhood, almost on every block, doing different kinds of things like funk and funk rock and the Latino music. And I can spend an hour just talking about bands from Queens that guys have come from and went on to make their careers.
What were a couple of the bands that you remember from Queens at that point?
Well, not only were there bands, but there were bands doing business, real record business, like Creative Funk, who had a number one or a number two R&B hit. I forgot the name of it now. But they had Denzel Miller in the band and Bernard Wright and Gary DeBerry. I mean, these guys were like the pillars of music. And they had their own recording studio in a garage, and they produced their own records and pressed their own records back then. So, I mean, we learned about the music business very young and how to promote yourself. So there was Creative Funk. There was a band called Willie Feaster and the Mighty Magnificence. There was Mother Night that had Eddie Martinez and Val Burke in the band.
Who are they?
Val Burke is, we call him Uncle Val. He was and still is one of the greatest bass players around. And he schooled great bass players like Marcus Miller and Barry Johnson and you know, all those cats, you know, came through that school of playing. And it was a very disciplined school of playing. Val used to run a jam session at this club called the Village Door, where he would have the fake book on the stand, and if you wanted to go on stage and play, he would flip the book and say, okay, let's play number 49, and you would have to sight read it, and if you didn't sight read it, you'd have to get off the stage, like, get off, he would say, okay, get off, somebody else come up here who can do it, but that would motivate you to go home, study it, and come back, and then get it right, and it was about discipline, and it was an unbelievable environment. Eddie Martinez, great guitar player. He played with Robert Palmer and Tina Turner, and he's played with everybody. Ronnie Drayton. There's so much music. And the interesting part was different parts of Jamaica, Queens had different sounds. Like my neighborhood was Springfield Gardens, which was on the border of the white neighborhood. It wasn't like what we used to call the deep jungle, which was South Jamaica, South Side. So we were playing with the white musicians. I had the first integrated band in Queens. It was called Freight Train. I had two Greek guys in my band, and we used to play like Zeppelin covers and Cream and stuff, as well as Sly and Chambers Brothers. And so we were into that. But if you went deeper into Queens, they were playing the deep funk, you know. So it was a wonderful experience.
How did you wind up drumming?
That's a good question. I don't know. I've always been a drummer. I didn't even play another instrument. I just heard the drums at Artie Simmons' house, and that was it. I've always been drumming since 10 years old.
And your parents got you a set of drums at 10?
Yeah, my mom was a lover of music, and she always pushed me. She was into the arts. She used to stand in the house on Sunday. My dad, who used to hold three jobs, you know, he was tired as heck.
Right.
So he's sitting on the couch sleeping, and my mom would be standing next to him with a New York Times going, "We're going to the opera today." And my dad would go, "We?" And he would get up and take us to the opera or whatever she was planning. He supported that, you know. And so I was always exposed to art, dance, painting, the planetarium. And I believe so that's what you need to do for your kids. You need to expose them to the world, and you never know what's going to inspire them. Thank you.
So at what point does drumming begin to take a turn and you begin to realize that this is something really serious and you're really beginning to get into it?
Well, going back to the Artie Simmons story, back then in our neighborhood, all the doors on my street were open. We used to watch each other. The community feeling, my block was a safe house. I could go down the street if my parents were late. So I was always across the street playing on those drums. And I remember Artie's father was a policeman, and he used to work the Harlem shift. And he would come home, and he'd hear this kid bashing on the drums. And I remember his mother coming downstairs going, "You keep going. I'll take care of him. You know, just keep going." And that kind of support is what gave me the fire to keep going. And Artie was my first teacher. He taught me how to read charts, and from there I was in it. I didn't get my first drum set, though, till I was 13. I kept begging my dad, and we were kind of tight on money. Drums and equipment was very expensive on our income, so I was playing those drums across the street.
This is a little bit of a step back, but I didn't want to let it slide. Can you talk about some of the clubs that were around in Queens at that point? Because we were talking off mic just before this started about the difficulty of you even performing your music in New York.
Yeah, well, there was the Club Ruby in Jamaica, Queens. The Village Door, which had jam sessions four times a night and great Chinese food. And there was Gerald's. Well, that's where I cut my teeth, in those clubs that let young musicians. I mean, these clubs were selling liquor, but if you were a musician, they would let the kids in and let them play. I was too young to go in all these clubs, but I started hitting, and by the time I was 14, they let me sit in. But this is where you cut your teeth. And the older musicians were so supportive. You know, they helped you grow, and I started getting gigs around the neighborhood.
I know in 1976, you do an international tour with Bobby Humphrey. And we've done a little bit of research. How does that come about? How were you selected?
Well, this is the thing. What I was talking about, my mom was talking about fertile soil. All the musicians in Queens were starting to get professional gigs. And her manager, they all knew about the cats in Queens. And they just took a bunch of guys. And, you know, they didn't pay us much. But we could, you know, the young cats. I was still living at home. And she just chose the best music. And it was an audition. And we went in there and killed it. And then, you know, they paid us. I don't remember how much it was. It's like a cell phone bill or something today, a week, no per diem, threw us all in one hotel room. But we wanted to play. And it was a great experience. I'm still friends with Bobby. We talk all the time online. That's how they found us. Some guys went out with Wilson Pickett, or they went out with Dwight Gassaway, who was a great vibist in Queens, or Walter Perkins.
The pianist,
Walter Perkins. So we started working very early, and once you got that bug, there was no turning back after that.
When you say they all knew about the musician in Queens, was it simply just part of being on the New York scene, or was the reputation much wider and larger than that?
Well, I wasn't aware of the reputation. I just knew I was just doing what the older cats were doing, and you just get pulled in with the wave of cats come. That's the fertile soil reference. You just get pulled in with cats. I tell that to my students now. You know, make sure you surround yourself with people that are moving up. Don't sit around in the mud over here. Get in that fertile soil where things are growing. And that's how you get noticed. You know, I mean, that formula I still use to this day. You know, and I've never been out of work in my career. You know, well, maybe a little bit, but the typical artist out of work. But you know what I mean. In fact, the mental attitude of being in fertile soil and constantly learning and being positive and being around people that also want to learn, you can't have a negative result with that attitude.
So when you did the tour with Bobby Humphrey, was that your first time leaving Queens?
I left home. That was the first time I left home. In fact, my mom packed for me. I can't believe this. She's in heaven now. She packed my bags, and she was half crying, half smiling. Okay, go ahead, boy. You did it. Yeah, that was my first time away.
How was that for you as a growing human being and as a musician?
That's when I learned how to be a professional. Being a professional is different than being an amateur. You need to show up every night. Nobody needs to know if you had a bad day. I learned that. Bad days don't count when you go on stage. The audience pays money to see you. You need to bring it every night. You know, I would wake up in the middle of a tour like, I don't feel like playing today. Oh, I have to play today. And it took me a while to learn what being a professional was about. Not just being on stage, but being reliable, being accountable. Because you can just go right back to the back of the line and wait. And I wasn't going to do that. So that's when I started learning what being a professional is about.
How was Bobby as a leader? And what else did you get from that?
She was young, too. So she was learning, too. But she was just such a talented and charismatic person. And she was surrounded with some very supportive people. George Butler, people like that. And as a kid, and I was a kid, I thought I was a star. I wanted to play on the records, and I thought I was ready. And they never used us on the records, and I was really frustrated. Then we go, oh, come on, they used Bernard Purdy and Ron Carter and Earl Klugh. What are you arguing about, boy? Because you want your piece. So I had to learn about being patient, too, as well as being a professional. But she always was supportive of her band, and we traveled, and, you know, it was wonderful. But she was learning as we went along, too.
So your first recording dates, when do those happen?
We used to do the cool jazz festivals. I don't know, you guys remember those cool jazz festivals where, like, everybody was there? I was so in awe because, you know, Stanley Turrentine was there and Freddie Hubbard and Herbie Hancock. I mean, everybody. Thelonious Monk. The guys were there. And Stanley heard our rhythm section with Bobby. So after she got off the road, he picked us up and wanted us to join his band. Myself, Gary DeBerry on bass, and Robert Banks, who's a great guitar player, who kind of like off the scene right now. And he had Bruno Carr, the great Bruno Carr on drums, and Toru Nakamura and John Miller on keyboards. So I'm replacing Bruno Carr, which is a great honor. You can take a drum chair, you know, you have to respect who sat in that chair first. Bruno played with Stanley for decades. And I have to say this, Bruno was so supportive. You know, this little green skinny kid from Jamaica was coming in to take his place. And he never said a negative word. He was always supportive. He was saying, go on, man, you know, and play. And it was such a great experience. I was very green. And some of the music, I didn't have enough vocabulary yet. But Stanley let me learn on stage. He had this reputation of being a hard kind of G guy. But see, that didn't fool me because my dad was a hard G guy. But I knew he was a softy. My dad was a softy. So Stanley was the same, so I could read him. And he just taught me on stage. He would stand over me and just berate me. Come on, man. Just come on. But he never fired me. So I must have been doing something right, you know. So he was just bringing me along. So I stayed with Stanley for about 4 or 5 years, but I never recorded with him. And I never asked because he was using the masters. But what he taught me, I still use today as a drummer. He actually projected to me that the drummer is the leader of the band. You're not just sitting back. If this stuff ain't working, nothing is working. And that's when I understood what the responsibility was, what it takes every night. You need to show up. And I got that. And I have this great story about Stanley. One day we were playing the old jazz workshop in Boston. But 2 days before that, we were playing in Philly and D.C. So I was driving back then. I drive up from Philly, and I want to stay in my house before I drive to Boston. I have a day. Drums are in the car. Clothes. You know where this is going.
Unfortunately.
Of course, I didn't unpack. I said, I just want to sleep in my own bed. And I go, 5 o'clock, I'll hit it and get up to Boston. I go downstairs, my car, drums, clothes, everything is gone. I'm sitting on the curb crying like a baby. And this is before cell phones, everything. I called Stanley. Stanley, you know, my drums are gone. He goes, make the gig, you know. Get on a train, get your ass up here. And, you know, still I was young and green. I didn't understand he's contractually responsible. His name is on the billboard. So I get on the train. I go up there. I don't have any clothes. I walk into the jazz workshop. I made it on time for sound check. And I walk on stage and there's a brand new drum set on stage that he bought for me. That's when he broke his ice. He says, this is yours. We're on tour. You can work it off. You made the gig. And I'll never forget him for that.
right. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is actually the name of this program. A sort of abbreviated version because of time and trains and what have you. And I apologize. And it will never happen again if I have anything to do with it. I had nothing to do with it this time. Out of my control. I just need to accept that. In any event, what you're listening to right now is Where I Stand. It is from Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman, I Am a Man. And, let's see. Let's listen to this for a second. I need to get my hands on something. Yes, I Am a Man. It's Harriet Tubman. When is this thing released? Oh, goodness. It's some funny-looking something that I shouldn't have. Well, that's J.T. Lewis on drums, Brandon Ross on guitar, and Melvin Gibbs on bass. And I'm looking for something that I'm not seeing, which is not good. But, it was recorded in 1998. Let's hope it was released at that time as well. And what is this label? This is a strange thing I am looking at. It is on the Knitting Factory's record label. That's what it's on. That's probably why it looks kind of strange. And, let's see, before that we heard, There Goes the Neighborhood, and that's from Prototype. Harriet Tubman, in case you hadn't noticed, J.T. Lewis is the drummer with Harriet Tubman, co-conspirator. And before that, we heard Adapted, also from I Am a Man. And before that, we heard our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl by Nina Simone. And, wow. Stay tuned for more J.T. Lewis and more wonderful stories by J.T. Lewis. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the web.
Broke character, and I still have that drum set today. It's in my dad's house in the basement. I don't even take it out. It was a beautiful Gretsch ebony wood drum set that he bought for me. He was just such a loving guy. That's when he really started teaching me, because during that time, the CTI All-Star bands used to alternate rhythm sections. So one night, George and Stanley and Freddie, they would use George's rhythm section. The next night, they would use our rhythm section. We would switch. And Stanley would never let me open up, try to play like Tony, because I wasn't ready. So he would stand over me and go, this is what I want you to do. Now, I don't know if you guys understand this, But he would want me to play quarter notes on the foot while I was swinging, which is what Max and the, but I didn't know that. This is how you do it. This is the foundation. At any tempo. This is what I want you to do. And I looked at him like, I'm not doing this. You're going to do it. So for 6 months, I'd have to play the bass drum with the swing on top. Finally, I started getting it where at any tempo. Then it was a CTI All-Star concert at Carnegie Hall. We're playing at home. And my mom's sitting in the front row. And he comes over to me and he goes, you can let go of the foot now.
So you had graduated.
Yeah. I just looked at him like, well, I must have been doing something right. What I realized was I still heard it in my head. I mean, that was the hard lesson, you know. And from then on, you know, I was just eternally grateful for the experience with him. Now, getting to recording, it took me a while. You have to be humble, and you have to earn your place. You're not going to, like, take Grady Tate's place, Charlie Persip. You need to earn your spot, Bernard Purdy. So after I left Stanley, the funny part is I don't remember how I left Stanley. I think he took a sabbatical, and I needed to keep working. And I had some friends in the Roy Ayers band, the Ubiquity band, and they called me one night. This is a funny story. Philip Wu, the keyboard player, called me from SUNY Purchase. He says, JT, you need to get up here. The drummer's really having problems. Back in the day when it was 75 cents a gallon, I went to my dad. I was still living at home. I said, Dad, can I have $10? I'm going to get a gig. And my father looked at me like this. Okay. Took out his wallet, handed me the $10. I filled up the tank with $5. So I had $5. I drove up to SUNY Purchase, and I made it for sound check. And I walked up to Roy, and I said, I can do this. And Roy looked at me like, go play sound check. And he hired me on the spot. Part of it I feel good about. The other part I don't feel good about, because he fired the drummer on the spot. Oh. He was sitting in the audience watching this whole thing. But this is the cruelty of the business. And one day it's going to happen to me. Or it could happen to you. You know, it hasn't happened. Ain't going to happen.
Right.
The transition, you know. I felt bad. I was really arrogant. But, you know, when you're young and you want to get in a spot, you have to take your spot. And he respected that. I saw him at the Jacksonville Jazz Festival last year, and he goes, you were an arrogant kid. I said, no, I wasn't arrogant. I was confident. He goes, yeah, okay. But he's the one that gave me my first recording date.
On You Send Me.
Yes, who I was really grateful for that because, and this is another teaching tool, which I use now with my young students. He called me into the studio when they were recording that album, and he said, Jay, come down. I think it was Sigma Sound. And he said, come down to the studio. We're going to record. So I show up, and Bernard Purdy is down there cutting tracks. And I'm like, I'm pissed. Not even realizing that, wait a minute, I'm paying you to sit with the master and watch him. You know, he paid me for showing, and I was still angry. Because I didn't get it. I'm a hardhead. He says, here's $500. He just gave me $500 because he hired me to do the session. But just sit under, just go in there and sit in the booth. Like, I'm getting lessons, man. Purdy was great. We're still great friends. So the last track was You Send Me. And he goes, JT, go play the track. Because I watched how Purdy tuned the drums, how he played with, yeah, I just watched everything.
I know you
So that was my first recording, 1976.
It took me a while
to learn
the value of
the masters of our music. But they never berated me. They just said, just go over there and sit down and shut up. Yeah, and I have students like that now, you know.
You've talked a lot about the informal and, well, I guess possibly even formal training you've gotten just through being in the music. But can you talk a little bit about the academic training? Because you went to City College of New York, if I'm correct. So how does that fit in, and how do you begin to square the formal academic training at City with what you've been learning from the masters?
Well, CCNY had a great jazz program when I was there. I mean, Jackie Byard was there, John Lewis was there, Ed Summerlin, which he became my mentor, ran the jazz band there. We had Charlie Primeri was there. Sam Rivers was up there, and so it was incredible. And I was just there to learn. I didn't waste any time. I left early. A lot of great drummers were there when I was there. Adam Nussbaum was there when I was there. Trevor Gale was there. And they used to tell me that, in fact, I ran into Trevor just recently. He goes, I never got a chance to play when you were there because Ed always let you play. I was like, hey, you know, sorry. And he was just a great teacher. He let me experiment. I had the keys to all the practice rooms. I had the keys to his room. I could read his scores. I was voracious. You have to be voracious if you really want to do something. You have to be hungry. And you have to, like, study, but really study. You know, not just, like, scratch the surface. You have to, like, get in there.
Over in Shepherd Hall.
What do you know about Shepherd Hall? You went to CCNY?
Yes, I did.
Oh, man. Okay, so then you know what I'm talking about. That part of the campus, there was a lot of music there. I was working already, though, and the gigs started coming in. I remember I had to take a leave of absence. You know how you always had to go to the head of the department to say, well, why are you leaving? And I said, well, that was when I got the Turrentine gig. I said, well, I'm going on tour with Stanley Turrentine. And he said, well, I want to play with Stanley Turrentine, too. But you got to come back. And, you know, life has other plans for you. So I never had a chance to really go back. But the education that I got there, the 2 years I was there, was incredible.
You ever think about going back there?
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm actually teaching now at a university. But the performance degree that I got through the years now, you can't get in school. That's why they hired me. And I think that my parents used to really, they were really kind of upset, too, that I left. And I understand it because my kids are finished, and I'm glad that they did. But I just had this instinct saying, well, I just let the sales take me where, you know, I went from Stanley Turrentine to Herbie, and it just went that way. And the lessons you get from the masters, sometimes you got to chase the masters down.
Well, you said you were with Herbie.
That was about 12 years after I left school, but it was the rocket period. But just being able to hang with Herbie for 4 years was just like, he's an encyclopedia. Those opportunities, which is another thing. I didn't create, well, maybe I did create, I didn't write a plan saying, okay, I'm going to go to Herbie. I'm going to go, no. But the spiritual preparation I was prepared to do, the work, the real work, the inner work. And this is where the line between school and creative life is blurred. Like I notice that there are teachers in the university that they're not really performers. You don't get a chance to taste what it's like to play with Ornette and get that school, that real school. And the schools are not hiring real cats because they might not have the paper, but they did the work. And so that's where we are now. The lessons I learned from the masters is priceless. From the rock masters and the jazz masters. I mean, think about it. I went from Turrentine. Then I played a lot of rock. I did Garland Jeffries. I did Lou Reed. I did Sting. Then I went from Sting to Don Pullen. Don Pullen to Kip Hanrahan. Kip Hanrahan to Henry Threadgill and David Murray. I mean, we're talking about school, you know. But the lessons that I've learned from the masters, you had to go out there with them. You have to climb that and meet them up there on that thing to get the information.
This is usually something that I ask toward the end, but is there anything like that now that is the opportunity still there? Because it seems that, you know, the university is the only place that people can go. There aren't as many venues. So what do you see?
Not that many gigs around either. Yeah, I mean, there's some cats out there, but I mean, Henry's still working. David Murray's working. Oliver Lake's working. They still hire young cats. But now we're the elders. So Steve Coleman. These are the guys. You know what I mean? Mark Rebo, you know? Guys like that, that learned from the masters. What I've learned now is that the school, there's only a few lines that take you to the roots of the history of our music, of black music. There's the school from New Orleans. There's the school from Chicago. There's the school from Mississippi. But there's the cats that come from that, like Ornette, like Henry. And if you're getting that school, then you're getting that training. And I'm just grateful that I'm a part of that.
And that's why Harriet Tubman has its sound, because we got the information from the real cats.
right. They got the message from the Cats. They're the new Cats now. They're the new old Cats. Harriet Tubman, member. J.T. Lewis, drummer. On This Is Still Got the Blues by Stanley Jordan. I'm not going to say too much because I ain't got too much to say. He has more to say. And besides, we have to get ready to hear the bandstand. But I got this from a compilation, The Best of Stanley Jordan, The Blue Note Years. And it is... what was it originally from? It was originally from... Cornucopia, which was released in 1989. And Stanley Jordan. It has J.T. Lewis, our guest, on drums, Yossi Fine on bass, Bernard Wright, who J.T. Lewis mentioned earlier from Queens, on keyboards, Stanley Jordan on guitar. And before that, we heard Roy Ayers' You Send Me. Well, that's the only one there was to choose from, so I thought I'd play the Roy from 1978, as mentioned. And J.T. Lewis, that was his first recording there. Stay tuned, as I mentioned. Coming up next is On the Bandstand. And, you know, squeeze in as much of this as we can. For those who... I went to the Vision Festival. It's like I shouldn't have gone, but I had to. I had to go. So I was made to pay for my... I also went to the Tribute to the Ancestors, which I had to go to at Coney Island, so... And where was Hapte Selassie anyway? But stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. The bulk of our exchange was conducted by our associate producer, Hank Williams. So thank you for the great questions, Hank. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for June 15th. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar in My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. This week's guest is drummer J.T. Lewis, who will be appearing with Sandra St. Victor at Prospect Park's Celebrate Brooklyn series on June 30th. Later this summer, you can also catch him in Damrosch Park on August 8th at Lincoln Center's Out of Doors Festival with vocalist Cassandra Wilson. Details on the Brooklyn event are at brickartsmedia.org. That's BRICArtsmedia.org. And you can find info for the Lincoln Center event at lcoutofdoors.org. And if you follow this segment, we'll give you a reminder as the events draw closer. On June 16th, vocalist and pianist Andy Bay does a solo performance at the Blue Note. Details are at bluenote.net. That's bluenote.net. Drummer Terry Lynn Carrington and pianist Jerry Allen will be at the Village Vanguard from June 17th to 22nd. VillageVanguard.com has info on these shows. Pianist Harold Mayburn returns to Smalls on the 18th. See SmallsJazzClub.com for info. Vocalist Diane Reeves has a free outdoor concert with the New Haven Symphony Orchestra at New Haven Green in Connecticut on June 21st. See the symphony's website at newhavensymphony.org for details. That's newhavensymphony.org. And the Blue Note Jazz Festival continues with events in several venues. See bluenotejazzfestival.com for a full schedule. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. For those of you who heard our Vision Festival 19 show, we have highlights of it and a review up on the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at Give 2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, where you can consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We'll see you next week, June 22nd, on air and online on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
We didn't get some fake information. You know, we got the real information. I'll tell you this story. The first gig Harry Tubman played was at Tonic, and I think about five people showed up. Rashid Ali.
Drummer.
Billy Hart.
Drummer.
Henry Thregill. David Murray. And somebody else. I can't remember. But the cats with the information, they wanted to see what we were doing. And they all nod, just like you just nodded your head, they went, okay, go on now and do what you got to do. You know, because they know that we, all three of us, you know, like Brandon has played with Henry and Melvin has played with Shannon and Sonny Chirac. So they know that we had the information. They wanted to see what we were going to do with it. And they said, okay. In fact, Rashid came backstage and goes, what the hell are you guys doing? And that was the biggest compliment we could get from, you know, from a guy like Rashid. I miss him so much. He was so supportive.
Before we get deeper in that, there's one other thing that I want to follow up on, because we were talking about the idea of education, but it seems like one piece that's missing is that foundation that you got in Jamaica, Queens.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere where that exists now?
Well, let me tell you. When I was a kid in Jamaica, Queens, I could go to my school down the street and pick any instrument for free, sign for it, and keep it for a year. Now, when my little brother, who's 10 years behind me, went to that same school, there were no instruments, no music class, no gym. So this is what happened to our communities. No jazzmobile. They don't move around like they used to. You know, no culture. arts in the schools have been taken out. I was playing in the orchestra from junior high school to college. Jazz, orchestra, with a teacher who loved it, and they just wiped that out. The communities have been, like, devastated with lack of culture. And here's the beauty of it, though. There's always some beauty in there. Those kids figure out a way to create art. They went into Big Brother's room and pulled down the turntable, pulled out them old records, and created something. You can't stop creativity. It's like a flower coming up through the stone. And hip-hop now is what? It's the largest selling, but it came from nothing.
And it's over 30.
Yeah, these guys are middle-aged guys now. But my point is that creativity will never stop. But yes, the support in the community has definitely changed. And we're trying to give it back. We have a great jazz program at York College, and a lot of kids are coming in, and I'm enjoying it to death. Especially when they found out I'm from there. You from here, man? I'm like, come on, man. I'm here before Guy Brewer Boulevard was Guy Brewer Boulevard. It's called New York Boulevard. What?
Well, we're going to save this to the end, but what's teaching like, and has that changed your approach to making music any?
Teaching is learning. My wife is a professor, and she's been bugging me about teaching for years. She always said I would be a great teacher, because kids like me, and so once I started doing it, I really loved it. But teaching is mentoring. It's not just teaching. And it doesn't end when class ends. It actually starts when class ends. But it's made me a better musician also. I actually have to verbally explain what I do. It's been a challenge. The first semester for me was really a challenge because I actually didn't really think about what I don't think about it anymore. I just do it. But when a kid asks me, well, Mr. Lewis, how did you read that chart? How did you do that? And then I have to actually go, I'll get back to you on that. And I went home to think about it. And the next day I had an answer for him or her. And it's made me a better musician. I'm loving it. I love it. I love teaching. I'm teaching the summer session. When I come back from Japan, I'm going right back and teaching the summer semester from July to mid-August. I'm not even gigging. I'm teaching 5 days a week. For me, the grading is the recital at the end of the semester. And the heads come and they go, JT, those drummers sound good, man. I'm like, there you go. For me, the reward is watching the kids grow every week and move on to the next level. That's my reward.
You've played with so many people, but a few people jump out. Guitarist Mark Ribot, Sonny Chirac, and Pete Cozy. If we could just do a little bit of free association. Mark Ribot.
I think of a mad scientist who is constantly mixing up chemicals and waiting for them to explode. Volatile chemicals. He's fearless, and he just goes there. And he's such a great musician and a supportive musician and an activist. And a great human being. I mean, the first gig I did for him wasn't even a real gig. It was a benefit at his daughter's school that we were playing. We just met at Reuben Wilson on organ. The kids didn't even know who was on stage. You know, we just went up there and made some noise and played, and the kids were like, yay! We raised some money. So he's a real human being. You know, one of the rare, very rare human beings on the planet. I love working with him.
How about Sonny Chirac? When did you play with him, and how did that come about?
I met Sonny Chirac in the original Herbie Hancock Rocket Band with Bill Laswell. Now, the original Rocket Band had, now check this out, had Bill Laswell, Ronnie Drayton, DST, Michael Beinhorn on keyboards, and myself, and Keith Haring, the painter, the graffiti artist, and Herbie.
What was Keith Haring doing?
He was in the back, free-form painting. I mean, Rocket wasn't written yet. We were playing Henry Kaiser on guitar. Henry and Sonny and Ronnie Drayton. And it was wild. And it was great. And I was attracted to we just gravitated towards each other. Because Sonny is such an outrageous character on stage. But such a quiet man off stage. That intrigued me. And I realized that he was like a, not a time bomb, but he was recharging. He was such an intelligent, he just knew about so many things. Well-read man. And so on the tour bus, you know, we'd be talking about the universe or science or technology. And when he practiced his guitar, he would just practice arpeggios. You know, all his circle of fifths and ninths and twelfths. And then when he got on stage, he was a completely dissonant, mad scientist. And it taught me something about tonalities and the sound of, I was just starting to learn what that is, that I call it the angry black man sound, the shriek, the spiritual, there's really no word, you know, a train had it too, the cats have it, that sound that comes from, some people don't get it, but when you get it, you understand what that is, that's the pain, but also the joy of what we are, Not who we are, what we are, the spirits. So he was just playing the true, that primal scream, that primal black scream that I was trying to get to. And when I was playing rock, from Tina to Sting to, you know, my wallet was fat, but my spirit was empty. So, I was kind of self-destructive. I would get off stage and, make a lot of money, bought a lot of cars, blew it all and whatever. But then I realized that my spirit needed something. And once I got back to the real, I started hearing what this thing is really about, what my life is really about as a musician. It has nothing to do with money. It has to do with being real and honest. When I started hearing those cats, and they heard that in me before I did, because I could hear it. I was just like, oh. When I heard Sonny, I was just like, oh. When I heard Don, when he went into his thing.
Don Pullen.
And he heard me. Speaking of Don, I don't know. You guys are artists, too. But, we all hit a wall in our creative life. And, you don't know what path you're supposed to go on. And I usually trust the spirits in taking me. But I was in a dark place, and I was working. But I wasn't happy. And I ended up at this recording session at Kip Hanrahan where, Kip always throws everybody in there. Jerry Gonzalez was there and Giovanni and Andy Gonzalez, Fernando Saunders, Jack Bruce, Alan Toussaint, Don Pullen, all in one room. Me and Robbie Amin, El Negro, we're all in the room playing. So there's this cacophony of sound and you have to find your place. All of this stuff going on. So, you find your place. And Don walked over to me and he went, "You can play." And, I needed to hear that at a point in my career. And 6 months later, I was in his band. And then he took me on his journey. It's an amazing arc where music can take you.
Oh, the last guitarist, by the way, Pete Cozy. Oh,
yeah, I miss him so much. He stayed at the house, and we recorded here on Melvin's album. But he was such a gentleman, and I learned so much about just being who you are. The beauty of this job is, I'm going on 60 years old now, and I still have so much work to do. You never finish. This is the beauty of having an art that you can spend your life learning. So, I'm just beginning. And that's what Pete was talking about. It restores your faith in spirituality. I'm not talking about organized religion. I'm talking about spirituality. Things that you thought were correct are correct. And the magnet and your aura takes you to the people that think the same way you do. It took me a long time to get there, but I was determined to get there. And then create an atmosphere with people of like mind and spirit. Because at first, I started losing faith. It was real. But then when you put the music on, you go, okay, this is like when you listen to Train, still to this day, I can listen to Live in Paris or something, and tears just start flying. It's real. Everything that you thought was true is true. And you have these questions stored in your brain that if I ever meet this person, I'm going to ask him or her. When I met Betty Carter or whatever, you're going to ask. So when I was with Don Pullen, we toured for 2 weeks with the Elvin Jones Jazz. We opened for Elvin for 2 weeks, which meant that he's standing on the side of the stage watching me play. I was like, oh, Jesus, Lord. But he was just like me. He was a kid who loved what he was doing. And he was there for every set. And he was so supportive. And he loved Don. They'd known each other for years. But he would always come to me and go, "Take care of Don, man." In other words, drummers, do your job. But one day, as you grow, you still have things to learn. Don would never let me play the Brush songs on his records because my technique was terrible. He would always call an older cat. So one day we were at the San Sebastian Jazz Festival and we're standing at the bar and Don says to Elvin, JT's Brush is f***ed up. Well, that's what he said, though. JT's Brush stuff is really messed up, man. And Elvin goes, "Really?" And he says, "You got your sticks?" And he sees my bag. He takes my brushes out of the bag. And on the bar, he just goes, he goes, "You see that?" So I'm standing there with the master. I'm getting a free lesson from the master. He goes, on top of the bar. And it sounds like crystalline, like, whoa. And he goes, "It's like a souffle, no bubbles." Then he put my brushes back in the sticks. And I had to study that technique for a year. And then when we did the next Don Pullen record, he let me play brushes. In fact, he let me play brushes on three of the last songs that he ever recorded before he passed away. It meant so much to me on the Common Ground record.
Thank you.
And he's one of the most underrated pianists in the world. He was one of the great ones. The other thing about Elvin was I asked him about the quartet. I said, "Elvin, man, what was it like?" And he just said, a tear came out. He said, "It was once in a lifetime. You don't get those moments, you know." I said, "You guys were just like incredible. I mean, think about it, man, with Jimmy Garrison and McCoy. And,
right.
And you put it on. I'm getting chills just thinking about it right now. You know, I can't even imagine what that felt like. And he said it. He said, I don't have any words, you know. And it was just beautiful to be with him, you know, for 2 weeks. It was just, and watch him work and show up every night and give 110% every night. It's the beauty of the thing.
Seems like now might be a nice time to go into Ascension, the record you and Harriet Tubman have done.
Thank you.
It's very hard to, you have to be careful when you try to do a statement on a statement, because the gravity of it just pulls you into the trap where you end up sounding like that or trying to. And we just definitely, our motto is not. So we just use the inspiration that it gave us to create something else. The melody goes through it, but it's just our interpretation of the joy and the spirituality that comes from that record. For instance, the funeral dirge that Miles does for Duke Ellington on Get Up With It, it's called He Loved Him Madly. It has nothing to do with Duke at all, but it has to do with the dedication and the love of what Duke was doing. He didn't write a song to sound like Duke, but it's your interpretation of the joy you felt from listening to that. And that's what we were trying to do. The spiritual arc of, like, having gigs and being around fertile soil and all that stuff. And I find that it's strange, but for me it was normal. Like, I never auditioned for a gig. I was always caught up in a group of sound or cats that were doing things, and they went on to do things. But my preparation was the key. You know, I was always practicing and reading and listening. And I still, you know, you see my studio. I still do that. Ready for whatever calls. But to audition, I never auditioned. In fact, it makes me uncomfortable to think about if I had to, you know. Yeah, it's interesting though, right?
Yeah.
Because my students ask me, well, JT, how do you audition? And I just go, well, I never auditioned. And I had to really think about that. I'm sure cats would come and listen to me play. I don't count that as an audition. A cattle call. I've never done the cattle call. That's kind of rare, isn't it?
Very.
So we should probably start talking about Harriet Tubman now. And you referred to it as a think tank a little bit earlier while we were talking. Can you expand on that?
Well, it's evolved into a think tank, but it's basically a black trio of angry spiritual men that's trying to speak the truth. Now, you might get a different answer from the other two cats in the band, but it's just of like minds with information from the cats, and we're trying to move that information forward. The thing I learned from the elders, and a lot of them are gone now, cats are moving the way of the world. They want to know that the information they left down here is going to be used. It's our job to take this information and move it forward, you know. This is what I loved about Miles so much. He never looked back. I mean, what we call quote-unquote jazz, I mean, listen to, like, Kind of Blue and where he ended up. He never looked back. To Bitches Brew, to Get Up With It, he was still being marketed as a jazz musician. Well, what they call jazz, but what was that? Look what everything that came out of that. So we're just doing what we're supposed to be doing. I used to tease the guys because the boxes that the business tries to put you in and the period of music, which now I'm starting to realize is a renaissance period of when I came up in the 60s and 70s from Jimmy and all of that and Miles and Strain. And that period might never happen again now that I'm starting to realize it. But with all of that information, like, I used to feel like I'm all dressed up with nowhere to go. I started feeling that. And I said, well, forget this. We need to create an environment that we can use all of that information. So sometimes we might sound like Jimmy and Buddy Miles. The next night we might sound like Sonny and, you know, whatever. And it's an open river of consciousness, of information that we've carried with us, the vocabulary. We're going to do it, all that stuff. I'm not going to die like we're not using it. So this is what we're about. I still have a problem telling you what kind of music we play. What would you call it?
That was actually going to be one of the questions.
Let me ask you a question. What would you call our music?
Great Black Music.
Great Black Music.
That's beautiful.
Art Ensemble of Chicago.
One day I was in London. Lester Bowie was playing with the Brass Fantasy. I was playing with Don at the time. And we're standing at the bar and he goes, JT, what are you doing? I said, I'm here with Don. He goes, that's not what I asked you. He says, what are you doing? He said, do something. You have a lot of information. Do something. And those are the cats I try to make them proud. And that's when I started the band. So that's when I called these cats and let's get together. And when we finished the first Harry Tubman CD, we ran into him again about 2 years later, and I showed him the CD. I gave it to him, and he went, oh, okay. Nah, you're okay now. But guys like that, that are entrepreneurs, hustlers, that push their own music, that don't wait, don't read the reviews, that push the information forward, is what we try to do. Thank you.
Harriet Tubman is sort of Harriet Tubman plus, and now it's Black Sun. So you want to tell us about that project?
Well, it morphed into Black Sun. Cassandra Wilson, who stepped in fearlessly, and her and Brandon have been working together for over 20 years. And she showed up with a guitar, and she was sympathetic to our cause. And she's on the same mission that we're on, truth and praising the ancestors and educating the audience as we go along, which is a whole nother story about entertainment. Like, what is entertainment? It used to be entertainment was edutainment. She just stepped in and we just started writing music for the ancestors. And it just turned into something. So that's in the pipeline right now. We haven't recorded yet because she's busy doing the Billie Holiday album. But late summer, we tend to get back together and stir those pots.
Tell me about Middle Passage Squad.
Yeah, well, that's one of my solo projects, which is also a connection to Harriet Tubman. I have this concept of our journey as Black people, the diaspora, the Middle Passage through the islands and wherever they dropped us off. And those beautiful flowers of music that is Africa's genes pool. And I'm putting together different musicians from all over the world and starting to write some music on it. I have some stuff, but I don't want to play it yet. But I did one gig in Austria, and there were a lot of African musicians and Haitian musicians backstage. And I said, look at this. And some of them didn't even speak English, but they understood what I was saying. I said, they took us from Africa, and they spread us around. And here we are again together. They can't separate us. They're really upset about that, too, because they really tried. But Mama Africa has the juju that has kept us alive. Is what makes our music so special all over the world. From Garifuna music to reggae to calypso to, it's all Africa, to free jazz. So I'm getting ready to stir a pot of that. I work with an African musician from Senegal named Hervé Sam, great guitarist, and we're going to start from there. So this is a work in progress.
What is it about the sound of, or is it the sound of the electric guitar and electric bass that you like or that you find captivating?
I mean, I grew up with Jimmy. I grew up with the Band of Gypsies. You know, I grew up with Sonny Chirac. And the guitar is the sound of the 21st century. It exudes electricity and technology, and it moves. I mean, I could have been a guitar player, but I would rather just push the guitarist into the abyss, and we search together. But I've always been a guitar freak and an electrio freak. And our generation is the electric generation. It's that simple. I just like the volume. I like the textures. I like the textures of electric. Like Melvin plays like 12 pedals. So we can expand the sound. It's just about the technology and where we are today. Yeah, I love playing acoustic. But my generation came from Jimmy. You know, I come from that sound. And also, too, Harriet Tubman's sound is an urban sound. Like New York City never sleeps. Even when it's nighttime, there's sound going on. There's a siren. There's people outside, like right now. There's cars going by. And that background noise is part of music. It's part of our music. You know, the perpetual sound. And that's what we're about.
So what do we have to expect with regard to your dates? Do you have any dates in this New York, New Jersey? Hey, by the way, you play with Gravity. Howard Johnson's Gravity.
Yeah, we did the Tuba Euphonium International Festival for Howard Johnson. He received an award there. So, but when I get back from Japan on the 25th, I'm actually playing with the great R&B singer Sandra St. Victor for Celebrate Brooklyn on the 28th. Come and see us. We're going to be loud. A lot of guitar. Mark Machado as one of Vernon's proteges. He's killing. So I'll be there. But then Tubman is not doing, and Black Sun is not doing anything till late summer. August, around late August, we're going to be back on the prowl. I'll let you know.
And there's one thing we didn't mention with regard to one of your experiences, that you were the first drummer for Living Color.
No.
Okay, so that's just bogus just, then.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me feel like Pete Best of the Beatles. But actually, I wasn't the first. But I was one of the drummers in early. And Greg Carter played in the band before I did. He's a great drummer. But yeah, I was in the band during the starving period in the early 80s before I left for Herbie. In 84. Yeah, it was a great experience. With Carl James was on bass at the time. And Mark Ledford, the late Mark Ledford, was also in and out of that band before Corey. Well, actually, when Corey left to do Platoon, Mark Ledford came, took his place. But yeah, I was one of the drummers for Living Color, but not the first drummer for Living Color.
I want to make that clear.
Thank you.
What's the role of spirituality for you in the music?
Great question. Well, I mean, it's a lifestyle. When I come off stage, it doesn't change anything. It's taken a while for my kids to understand that. That, oh, wait a minute, Daddy has a set of things that he lives by, and it works for him. So some of them pick it up, some of them don't, you know. But train, and everybody would tell you this, when you come off stage, it doesn't change. So for me, the spirituality is trust and faith. Trust in the Creator, whatever that is. And that can mean anything to whatever. But I know for me, it has never failed me. When I open up and do what I'm supposed to be doing, it's right there. When I'm practicing, I can feel something standing over me like, go on, you know. And the interesting part is, when I talk to the elders about it, they don't even flinch. They go, yeah, yeah, that's what it is. I talk to Rashid about it all the time. He goes, oh, yeah, 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 I felt that. You know, because I used to talk to him about practicing, and I used to feel a presence in the room. But you see, you have to be open for it. But that is what it is. Tubman used to get on stage without any songs, which is really intimidating. We would have these buoys you could swim to if you start drowning. But you just go out there and then let the stream come down, but you have to be open to it. And this is our philosophy. It takes a while.
Well, thank you, J.T. Lewis. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for coming to Bed-Stuy.
And we look forward to hearing more from you.
It's going
to
be a great summer. It's coming. New stuff is coming. New healing music will be coming soon.
But in the meanwhile, we can catch J.T. Lewis with Sandra St. Victor at Celebrate Brooklyn on
June 28th, Prospect Park.
Thank you. That is it. That's our conversation with J.T. Lewis. I'd like to thank Associate Producer Hank Williams for conducting the bulk of the exchange. And, of course, thank you, J.T. Lewis, for your time in providing the space. And just to let you know, what you're hearing now is Canto por Adudua, which features Pete Cosi and Pedrito Martinez. This is Melvin Gibbs' Elevated Entity, 2009 Live Wired music release. Before that, we heard Of Passage from Treasure Hunt for the Prototype, Harriet Tubman. That is the exact title, not Prototype. Treasure Hunt for the Prototype. It's a 2011 Avant Records release. Before that, we heard Don Cherry, Resting on the Road, from Sacred Common Ground. That's the exact release title, Sacred Common Ground, a 1995 Blue Note Records release, which includes, of course, J.T. Lewis on drums, alto saxophone, Carlos Ward, Santi DiPriano on bass, Moore Thiam, on percussion, of course, Don Pullen on piano, and Joseph Bowie on trombone. And let's see, before that, we had the Bandstand with Miles Davis's Amandla playing in the background. And thank you, Hank Williams, for providing on the Bandstand as well. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next, and we'll be back next week, June 22nd. Thank you, David Kenny. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.